Today is Monday, June 12th. We're going to work on finishing up the heart information today. Okay, so we're going to review EKG there on page 40. Just run back through that one more time. Okay, Jessica, I got your recording turned on. Okay. Just to review what we covered last Wednesday after the test. I know brains are always fried after the test. It's worthwhile to cover this. With reading an EKG or electrocardiogram, we are looking at what is considered here to be a normal sinus rhythm. This is picture perfect. This is how ideally it should look. If you don't move and your heart's beating just at this resting rate of 75 beats per minute. This cardiac cycle begins where you've got a P wave and then a massive QRS wave followed by T, and sometimes you get to see a U wave there. Keep in mind that these waves correspond to ions flowing into or out of our cells. You're not actually seeing contractions here. You're actually seeing sodiums flooding in, potassiums flowing out. So when we start this whole thing, we're going to appreciate that the SA node sets the pace as our pacemaker, and it fires an impulse telling our two atria to contract. As a response, sodium flows into the two atria, giving us which wave? P wave. Good, that's our first one. Okay, so SA node fires. That causes sodium to flood into your atria, and that depolarization is showing up as a P wave. Okay, technically it's called atrial depolarization. We follow that up with the nerve impulse reaching our AV node. The AV node sends a nerve impulse down the bundle of His, splits them to two branches, and those branches then split into these Purkinje fibers that innervate the walls of your two ventricles. When those Purkinje fibers release acetylcholine, we're going to now tell your ventricles to depolarize, meaning they're doing what? Yes, sodium's coming in, and they're getting ready to contract, yeah. And so which wave now shows up on this EKG? QRS. Yeah, QRS wave shows up. So that QRS wave happens to hide some stuff that's happening. We are hiding the atria actually contracting, and we're hiding the atria repolarizing. What does it mean to repolarize muscle cells? Good. Yeah, return it back to the resting state. So pretty much the only thing you see here for atria is that P wave, and their story is hidden then behind that big QRS wave. All right, so we know that the atria contracted behind the QRS. Where do the ventricles contract? Yeah, after the QRS, before the T, right? So what happens at the T wave? Repolarize, right, and that means the muscles in the ventricles are relaxed. Yeah, so if they're relaxed, that means they must have contracted sometime between that S and the T wave. So yeah, T wave is ventricular repolarization, and you may or may not see a U wave, but if you do, what does it indicate? Yeah, papillary muscle repolarization. So like I said, not a big deal that you know the U wave, but P, QRS, and T are the big ones to know here. On average, since we're looking at a resting heart rate in an adult at 75 beats per minute, how long should your average cardiac cycle be?
0.8
seconds. 0.8 seconds, that's it, good. So this average cycle is about 0.8 seconds. I do want to mention that if you're counting the rate, let's look at this one. If you're counting the rate, the heart rate, we don't necessarily look for P wave to P wave. Instead, what are we looking for? R. Yeah, look at those R peaks. They stick up here. And each of these big boxes is how much time? 0.2. Yeah, so you know, if we were to count the time between each of these R peaks, we're looking at around 4 or 5 seconds of time. How about the timing between these R peaks? Pick any one of them, make that 0, 0.2, 0.4. So that tells me that every 0.4 seconds there's an R wave coming at us. And if normal is 0.8, we're going double time, right? And if normal heart rate is 75 beats per minute, what's twice that? Like 150, right? Does this classify us as normal, bradycardia, tachycardia? Tachycardia, yes. Yeah, so this definitely falls into that range of faster than 100 beats per minute. Good. All right, so that's about where we were in class on Wednesday after the test. Is there anything else I can clarify or review for you on EKGs? I am recording that, yeah. Just make sure I click the button. Yeah, we're good. Hey, Jenny. So you listen to it, you'll get there. All right, let's go over to page 42. Why don't we start diastole and systole there? Okay, so this is storytelling, and if you do want to go home and repeat this, this is a great way to use the class recording. Go home and play it back and walk and talk yourself through it. I'll talk more at the beginning, and then I'll ask more questions as we get further into this process. Diastole can sometimes be called diastole. You may have heard it that way. Systole is sometimes called systole. No matter how you look at it, the terms there, diastole and systole, mean something. Diastole means heart is in relaxation, and systole means contraction. If we simply say diastole and systole, and we don't clarify which set of chambers we're referring to, then we're to assume the reference goes to the ventricles. Why are the ventricles so important? Yeah, they do the most work. They push the blood out. So they're going to be the ones that we are referring to if we don't clarify and say ventricular diastole or ventricular systole. There is such a thing as atrial diastole and atrial systole. And I'm going to walk you through all four phases. But I just want to appreciate that leaving off that specific set of chambers gives us reference then back to those ventricles. Let's see, I included a chart at the top of your page for you. It came from the American Heart Association, and it deals with blood pressure. So the whole point of having a heart to pump the blood is to create enough pressure to get it out to those extremities. You'll notice that normal on that chart near the very top looks like around, for systolic numbers, what is a good normal number? Yeah, 80 to 120 for the systolic pressure. And how about a diastolic value? What's a good range there?
60 to 80.
60 to 80, okay. And then if you get into the hypertension stage 1, you'll notice you're above 140 for the systolic value, looks like above 90 for the diastolic value. So as we continue to get higher, we get into different stages of hypertension. What does hypertension mean? High blood pressure, right. What if you go in the opposite direction? What if you happen to have at the very top up there something like blood pressure of 70 over 40? Hypotension, good. So, of course, hyper going into the too high range, hypo going too low. So what kind of problems do you see if we have hypotension?
Faint.
Faint, yeah. Brain may not be getting enough oxygen. Of course, fainting would be one way to hopefully help the brain get some oxygen. Let's see, what are some problems with not delivering oxygen to your cells and tissues? What might happen to them? They'll die, yeah. So having low blood pressure can be dangerous for not delivering or perfusing your cells and tissues with oxygen. Let's head in the opposite direction. What kind of dangers come from having high blood pressure? Stroke, yeah. So that pressure is going to push against the walls of your vessels, and the higher the pressure, the harder that blood pushes against those walls. So imagine blood as bruising and beating up the inside linings of your vessels. The higher the pressure, the harder that blood pushes and bruises your wall lining. Well, we know when bruising occurs, what happens to blood? Clots, yeah. So there's that risk we run for having clots break free and travel. Okay, so I wanted to mention what these numbers mean here. We would say this is 120 over 80. What does that top number indicate? Systolic pressure, good. And what does systolic pressure indicate is happening in the heart?
Ventricles contracting.
Ventricles contracting, good. And then the lower number there, over 80, that's a diastolic pressure. And now what are the ventricles doing?
Relaxing.
They're relaxing. Good. So it's hard to imagine that when you're relaxing, you still have pressure. So if the ventricles are relaxing, what chambers are actually contracting?
Atria.
Yeah. So we're actually looking at those two chambers working in opposite to one another. What does MMHG stand for? Millimeters of mercury. Good. So what in the world is this? It's a unit of measure, and when we use a sphygmomanometer, you know, the blood pressure cuff, that is the distance that a column of mercury rises with the pressure. So, you know, the cuff, of course, closes off the blood vessel's blood flow, and then we tighten that cuff and let the blood push against that cuff so we can register the pressure and the amount of mercury that it raises in a column. All we need to know, it's a unit of measure for blood pressure. All right, so I'm going to start you in what's called mid to late ventricular diastole. If any of you happen to have an old course pack, I've made the headings here a little more specific. I just want to give you a heads up that there's a little slight change there in case you happen to have an older course pack. I did this change for the summer term. So we're going to start with this picture here. This is called ventricular diastole. It is very specific in telling you what's happening. So which chambers are we looking at? Ventricles. Good. And diastole means the ventricles are doing what?
Relaxed.
They're relaxed. Okay. So when you look at the worksheet, you say, okay, blood is flowing here under low pressure. Well, that makes sense because the ventricles are currently relaxed. So right now, you'll notice the bicuspid and tricuspid valves are actually open. And as blood returns into the two atria, it flows right down into those two ventricles. That is another reason we call ventricular diastole ventricular filling, because that's what we're doing. We're filling up those two ventricles with blood. So the right atrium right now is receiving blood from three veins. What is the one coming off the top side of the heart called?
Superior.
Good. And the bottom side of the heart?
Inferior.
Good. And the other one you can't see in this picture that comes from the heart itself?
Coronary sinus.
Coronary sinus. Good. So all three of those return deoxygenated blood to this right atrium. Since that tricuspid valve is open, blood flows down here into this right ventricle. Let's look at the left side of the heart. The left side of the heart is receiving oxygenated blood from where?
Pulmonary
veins. Good. You can see a couple of them sneaking out over here. So those pulmonary veins return oxygenated blood from the lungs back to the left atrium. That bicuspid or microvalve is currently open, and blood drains down into that left ventricle. So right now, it appears that everything is just in a relaxed state, and it is. Blood pressure currently is low in the heart. And to be specific, blood pressure in the left ventricle is around 80 millimeters mercury. So why are we talking about that left ventricle so much? To the bottom, yeah. Pumps out blood to the body. Why are we not so concerned about that right ventricle? Where does it send blood?
To the lungs.
To the lungs, yeah. So the pressure over here is actually something like 24 millimeters mercury. So there is a pressure difference based on which side of the heart you're working with. Okay. So about this time, the SA node is going to fire nerve impulse. And now we're going to move into what's called atrial systole. What does the SA node tell your two atria to do?
Contract.
Contract, good. As they prepare to contract, which wave shows up on that EKG?
P
wave. P wave, good. So atrial systole occurs, we're going to see the P wave show up, and of course those atria contract and push their blood down to the ventricles. So right now, your tricuspid and your bicuspid valve are still open, and we force the blood down here from the two atria. If we were to pause our story right now, how much blood is sitting in each ventricle? 120. Yeah, 120 milliliters of blood sitting in each ventricle. And your worksheet is in all caps here for you. It is called EDV or end diastolic volume.
They would both have the same amount in there, even though the left is bigger?
Same amount, yeah. At least that's what they tell us in terms of keeping things flowing. Okay, so end diastolic volume is the volume of blood in each ventricle at the end of diastole, around 70 mils of blood. And so we're going to work with that being pumped out as we go into the next phase. All right, so let's head into what's called ventricular systole. And you'll notice right now in parentheses it says atrial diastole. So what are the atria doing? They're relaxing. They said, hey, I did my job. I'm sitting back, right? So now the ventricles are going to put on their show. By this time, the AV node has received the nerve impulse. I'm going to switch over here to this picture. The AV node splits into a bundle of His, bundle branches. Those branches travel the walls and release acetylcholine onto those Purkinje fibers. And of course, those muscle cells will now get ready to depolarize and prepare to contract. So we are now moving into full-on ventricular systole or contraction. When the pressure begins to rise here, what kinds of anchors are going to pull these AV valves shut? Chordae tendineae, and they're anchored to little fingertips called
papillary.
Yeah. So when you start pulling down on those papillary muscles, when they shorten, they're going to pull those chordae tendineae, and that slams shut your heart valves. To be specific, it's these AV valves. Okay? Now, that's going to make a noise that we can hear with a stethoscope called a lub noise. So we often hear the lubbed up of heart contraction. It's not heart contraction, it's actually valve closures. So the closure of those first sets of valves gives you a longer lub noise. And we'll talk about the duck sound in just a moment. That's our semilunar valve slamming shut. All right, so pressure is now great. We've got these four, these two valve shut pores, and these four chambers are all closed off from each other. And at this moment, if we were to stop and measure, we would say that we have the same amount of blood in each ventricle. So we have what is called an isovolumetric contraction phase right now. And this is one of two times when you have all four heart valves currently closed. So in the picture on the left, we're getting ready to contract those ventricles. We just slammed shut your two AV valves, and we haven't yet pushed open those two semilunar valves. Since all four heart valves are currently closed and we're getting ready to contract, this is called isovolumetric contraction phase. Now, the pressure is so great that we're going to force open those two semilunar valves. The pressure is too much for them. They're like trap doors, so boom, that blood pushes against them. And through each ventricle there, we're going to eject about 70 milliliters of blood. Okay? And so that is a stroke volume that is pushed out of the heart into each trunk there, pulmonary trunk and into that aorta. By the way, what was our ADV in each of these ventricles? 120, yes. So we're going to leave behind a little bit of blood and pump out 70 milliliters with each contraction event. Let's play from the beginning. Okay, so we're going to start in what is called atrial or ventricular diastole. We're going to start there. This is a time when our heart is relaxed and blood is passively flowing into our two atria. Okay, so where does the left atrium receive blood from?
Pulmonary
veins. Right atrium gets blood from three locations. They are? Got it, good. So which side of the heart is getting oxygenated blood?
Left
side, and deoxygenated on the right, good. Right now the ventricles are just sitting there, it's a relaxed time period. Which valves are currently open? AV valves, yeah, they're currently sitting here open, okay? And blood is draining down into those two ventricles. About this time, we're going to get into atrial systole. So what pacemaker has to fire an impulse?
SA
node. Good. What happens as a result of that SA node firing an impulse?
Atria contract.
Good. They pump their blood through these two open AV valves down into the two ventricles. And if you were to measure the volume of blood in each ventricle, it'd be about how much? 120 milliliters. Good. That is a volume at the end of our ventricular diastole known as?
End diastolic
volume. Good. So we're done with ventricular diastole. The ventricles have been relaxed during this time period. Let's now switch to ventricular systole, which is a time when we experience contraction in those ventricles. Now, what node receives the nerve impulse?
AV node.
AV node, good. It travels down the bundle of His, splits into branches, and travels the wall into those Purkinje fibers. Those Purkinje fibers release acetylcholine. What happens next? Ventricles contract, good. So as the ventricle muscles shorten in their contraction, they're going to pull down on these papillary muscles that stick up into the walls of these ventricles. What is anchored to a papillary muscle?
Chordae tendineae.
Good. And that pulling down is going to slam shut AV valves. Good. So they're going to get slammed shut. You know, we're going to stepwise this through really slow motion, because right now we haven't pushed enough blood against those two semilunars to get them to open. So we're looking at all four heart valves currently being closed. This timing is known as?
Isovolumetric contraction phase.
Good. I know, what a name, right? Isovolumetric contraction phase. Iso means same, right? It's the same volume of blood. We're not changing the volume of blood. Each chamber is assumed to have a static or non-changing volume of blood. Well, the pressure is tremendous, especially in that left ventricle. It is so great that we push up against these two semilunar valves, and they are now forced open. How much blood is ejected every time your heart beats? 70 milliliters, good. And that's a volume known as? Stroke volume, good. So each ventricle is going to send 70 mils out into circulation. All right, so we're on the top of page 43. Volumes so far. When we're thinking about blood coming back into the ventricles, draining there passively, we talked about end diastolic volume being around 120 in each ventricle. SV stands for stroke volume, and that's the volume of blood that we eject from each ventricle out either through pulmonary trunk or aorta. You're left behind with around 50 milliliters of blood sitting there in each ventricle. If you follow the blood, say, from the left ventricle to the aorta, we're going to pump out 70 milliliters of blood from your left ventricle. We're going to send it out through your body's arteries, arterioles, capillaries, venules, and veins. And here comes those 70 milliliters of blood back into your right atrium, and it drains down to your right ventricle, where it rejoins the 50 milliliters left behind. And the next time your right ventricle contracts, we pump out 70 mils, and that, of course, goes to the lungs. So it's not that we're accumulating 120 plus 70. We're just taking 70 and letting it travel somewhere, and we're leaving 50 behind. So that way, we're always constantly pumping about the same amount of blood either to the lungs or out to the body. I did want to mention something called ejection fraction, or EF for short. Ejection fraction before?
No.
Okay. So a lot of hospital monitors put that little bit of info up there on the heart monitor. This is basically a ratio between your stroke volume and your end diastolic volume. And let's see, stroke volume is normally what, 70 milliliters? And EDV is normally 120 milliliters. If you do the math there, that's approximately 60% of the blood that you're pumping out with every heartbeat. So you'll notice the range on your worksheet. You know, if this was a grade on a test, it would not be a fantastic grade, right? But if you're looking at ejection fraction, the range there should be around, say, 50 to 65%. You know, if you've got a strong, healthy heart, then we're looking at pumping out around, say, 60% of that blood with every heartbeat. So what would, say, an ejection fraction of 30% tell you? Not enough blood's in circulation, right? So there's that low blood pressure and not enough oxygen going to those cells and tissues. So we can use that ejection fraction or percentage as a way to kind of estimate, are we getting enough oxygen out to the cells and tissues? All right, one more time from the top. I know you're going to get tired of me doing this, right? Hey, if you get tired of me doing it, good, we'll move on after that, right? Okay, so from the top, looking at ventricular diastole, we're in a relaxation period. Blood is draining back into the right and left atria under what type of pressure?
Low
pressure, good. Can you tell me the three veins that drop off blood in the right atrium? Good. Oxygenated or deoxygenated?
Deoxygenated.
Good. So SVC, IVC, coronary sinus drop off deoxygenated blood under low pressure in that right atrium. Left atrium receives blood from? Good. Under low or high pressure? Low pressure. Good. Good. All right. So which valves are currently open during ventricular diastole? AV valves, good. Which chambers are getting ready to contract?
The atria.
Atria, good. So what nerve impulse tells those atria to contract?
SA
node, good. So SA node tells the atria to contract. They push the blood that's in there down through open AV valves, and we gather the blood here in these two ventricles. Keep in mind, we're still in what's called ventricular diastole, but we just experienced atrial systole because the atria did what? They contracted. Good. Pause right now. We're at the end of diastole, and our volume in each ventricle is how much blood? 120 milliliters. Good. So about that time, the nerve impulse is going to reach over here to your AV node. Your AV node fires an impulse that travels down the bundle of His, splits into what? Bundle branches, and the walls it goes into? Purkinje fibers, good. And we tell those ventricles to? Contract, good. As the contraction is starting to occur, which valves do we now slam shut? AV valves, good. Producing a sound called?
Lub.
Right. So we lub shut those AV valves, and the pressure now is getting higher and greater. So which valves do we force open?
Semilunar
valves, good. Through each of those two arteries, we force how much blood?
70.
70, good. 70 milliliters, and that is a volume known as? Stroke volume, good. Leaving behind about 120 in each ventricle, that volume is known, or sorry, 50 in each ventricle, known as?
End-systolic
volume, good. So as the blood travels through these semilunar valves, the pressure is going to begin to fall because there's not the great force of blood keeping them open. So we have yet a second opportunity to have all four heart valves closed. The second chance is called the isovolumetric relaxation phase. This time, we're done with ventricular contraction, and we're heading back into a relaxation period. So there are, in fact, two time periods where all four heart valves are closed, but there is never a time when all four heart valves are open. Okay, so two times when all four are closed, but there's never going to be a time where all four are open. Guess what would happen to your pressure if you opened all the valves?
Way down.
Yeah, you'd die. You'd have no pressure. So you've got to keep the valves closed, not only to prevent backflow of blood, but to maintain the pressure. So now that we've ejected blood from each ventricle through the pulmonary trunk and aorta, and we no longer have the contraction pushing those valves open, we're pretty much back to where we started. Blood is passively draining into the right and left atria at the same time, flowing down to those two ventricles, and we're back to the very beginning in ventricular diastole. I do want to mention to you, though, when those two semilunar valves eventually slam shut, they're like little trap doors that go dup. So there's a second heart sound that we're going to hear when those semilunar valves slam shut. So the AV slamming shut produces a longer lub noise. The semilunar slamming shut produces a shorter, quicker dup sound. So we can certainly tell the story again today, but I think it might work better if you go home and let it kind of start to click, and then we can do the story again on this stuff, at least on Monday or Wednesday. That way you've got a chance to practice it a little bit. Is there any part of this that I can clarify for you? Okay, so now you know the story. You just have to go home and tell it to somebody about six times and get the stick, right? All right, so just a little bit of review here. What does this image look like we're doing? Yeah, don't worry about that arrow. That doesn't really tell us anything. But these black arrows coming down, your right is atrial diastole. So blood's just passively draining down into those two ventricles. There's no contraction there. What should this have looked like if it was atrial systole? Going up. So arrows have been coming from your ventricles where? Yeah, through the semilunar valves and out through the aorta and the pulmonary trunk. So what does ventricular systole mean? Ventricles are contracting, right? So that would have been arrows going up instead of down like you see here. Like that, right? Okay, so there you go. You've got AV valves closed, semilunar valves open, blood forcing up through the pulmonary trunk and aorta, so it definitely looks like ventricles are contracting. Good. I showed you this website in last class period. I just wanted to mention that that med movie at University of Utah is a great place to look. They have the heart sounds, the volumes, the EKG, and the contraction events. So that's a worthwhile one to look at if you're trying to get this stuff straight at home. I do want to mention on your worksheet, this is on page 43, right dead center of the page, right and left side heart pressure differences. Okay, so average right side pressure is different from left side pressure. Average right side pressure is 24 over 8. Okay, so average right side pressure is 24 over 8. Left side pressure is around 120 over 80. And I'm using those numbers off that American Heart Association box that I gave you. So right side, 24 over 8. Left side, 120 over 80. Why the difference? Yeah. Left side to the body, right side to the lungs. So big difference there. Just a little bit down here on valve issues, and then we'll try a break. There's incompetent valves, stenotic valves, and prolapse valves at the bottom of your page. This is an incompetent valve. It's one that doesn't shut properly. A lot of these valve issues are the ones that let blood backflow into a previous chamber. So if you're talking about an aortic incompetent valve, where is blood flowing back into? So what chamber sends blood to the aorta? Left ventricle, yeah. And if the aortic semilunar valve doesn't stay shut, if it's incompetent, that blood slides right back down into the left ventricle. Okay, so ultimately, where was that blood supposed to go? To the body. What impact will this have on your stroke volume? Decrease it. And how about your ejection fraction?
Decrease.
It'll decrease that too, yeah. So how do you think this person might feel?
Sluggish.
Sluggish, yeah. Lightheaded, headaches perhaps. Yeah, so if your incompetent valve is not staying shut, then the blood just backflows into the previous chamber. This one is a stenotic valve, meaning it's going to narrow on us. This is an aortic stenotic valve. And instead of letting 70 milliliters through, let's say it only lets 40 milliliters of blood through. Again, what impact does this have on your ejection fraction? Decreases it, yeah. How about your impact on stroke volume? Definitely decreases, yeah. So either way, you're looking at problems getting blood out in the circulation with either of these valve issues. One you may have heard of before is called an MVP. It's called a mitral valve prolapse, not a most valuable player, of course. Why do you think these left side valves have such issues? So much pressure, that's it, yep. So that mitral valve is dealing with a lot of pressure. So when the ventricle, the left ventricle contracts, it has to stay shut. If it prolapses, that means it kind of droops down into your left ventricle and it doesn't slam shut properly. So where is blood backflowing?
To the atrium.
Yeah, sure is. So let me see. I thought I had you a video to take a look at. All this is just music, so I won't bother to turn on the sound for you. But, and of course, they're showing us first a normal mitral valve. And then now notice it's an incompetent valve, one that's not really staying shut like it should. So where is that blood coming? Where is it coming back into? Left atrium, yeah. This one's kind of cool. It's, you know, like an echogram. And they're running the EKG down at the bottom for you. So you see the bicuspid on the left, the tricuspid on the right. And the cool thing is they're going to color code the blood in just a moment so you can see it backflowing. So it looks like flames shooting back over here, doesn't it? Yeah. Kind of makes you want to go into like sonography, doesn't it? No.
It's cool to look at.
Yeah.
Okay, so why don't we do a break? Come back, say about 2:10 or so, and then we'll see what we can do to wrap up this chapter. All right, so I just wanted to mention that cardiac output is on the top of page 49, and this is assumed to be the amount of blood that is being circulated by your heart per minute. Okay, at the top of page, 44, yeah. I apparently need new glasses. Top of page 44, and I've readed the course pack a little bit, so it may be a page or so off if you've got an old one, but yeah, cardiac output, or CO, is the amount of blood circulated by the heart in a minute's time. All right, so I do want to mention something you've covered before. Back when we talked about blood volumes, we said that females have around 4 to 5 liters of blood. Males have 5 to 6 liters, but on average, 5 liters is what we were going to use. So no coincidence, cardiac output is how much blood you've got, and we're looking at about 5 liters in circulation at a given time. Now, cardiac output is dependent upon two variables. One of them is stroke volume, or SV. The other is heart rate, or HR. We know we've just talked about stroke volume. That's about 70 milliliters ejected from each ventricle. And 75 beats per minute is what we consider to be an average resting heart rate for an adult. So you do the math, and we've got 5,250, or approximately 5.25 liters of blood circulated per minute. That's pretty close to our average of 5 liters in circulation by the average human being. I do want to mention that these are all directly proportional to each other. These variables are all influential on each other. So let's say that you begin to exercise. Upon exercise, you may double your heart rate to 150 beats per minute. Well, that's going to increase the demand for blood being distributed to your body, so that will then in turn increase the stroke volume. And if you increase stroke volume and heart rate, what happens to your cardiac output?
Increases
too. So at the height of exercise, you may be looking at 10, 12, or even 15 liters of blood being circulated per minute, and that's okay because you're exercising. But when we consider this to be the normal value at rest, about 5 liters of blood at rest. So this particular value that we're talking about right now is the number one influence for blood pressure, something we're going to hit in the next chapter. Let's see, I summarized stroke volume, ESV, and EDV for you there. Oh, we just did that on the board, so I'll leave you to look through that in case you need it. And near the bottom of the page, I did want to mention that there are some things that influence stroke volume, or the amount of blood that you can eject per every heartbeat, and they're called preload, contractility, and afterload. So if you think about the blood coming into the heart that drains into the right atrium from SVC, IVC, and coronary sinus, and that drains into the left atrium from the pulmonary veins, this blood ultimately is going to head down to the two ventricles. We think of this blood as being preloaded into the heart. What does the blood in the ventricles do to the walls of those ventricles? Stretch them, yeah. So if you ever have made a water balloon, you know the more water you put in a water balloon, the greater the walls of the balloon stretch, right? You better get that water balloon off the water source because eventually it's going to rupture. Same concept here with your heart. As blood comes into these two ventricles, the walls begin to stretch, and that's going to make the contraction have to be strong enough to eject that blood out. So preload, you'll notice there on your worksheet, is increased by anything that increases blood flow back to the heart. Exercise is a great example of something that increases preload. Preload is decreased by a drug called nitroglycerin. I know you guys have heard of nitro tabs, right? Okay, nitro gel adhesive gels and all that stuff. So nitroglycerin is a vasodilator. It reduces the oxygen demand by your heart muscle tissue, thereby lowering the amount of stretch that your heart experiences. So if you had to remember one word to keep in mind preload, I would think about the word stretch. Okay, because it's the amount of stretch the walls of those ventricles must experience. Let's talk about strength for just a moment. Contractility is the strength of the muscle contraction. I want you to think about underwear for just a moment. Okay, brand new underwear, recently purchased, has really nice contractility. What do we mean? If you stretch the elastic and you let go, it pops back, right? Okay, that's good contractility. That's efficiency in terms of contractility. Let's think of underwear that really should have been thrown away a couple of months ago. What happens when you stretch it?
It stays.
So unfortunately, when you stretch it and you let go, it doesn't have the strength to be able to return back to its original position. So contractility depends on the strength of the muscle contraction, which in turn depends on how much you can stretch it. We just stretch this muscle tissue. That's preload. If you've got strong, healthy muscle tissue and you let go, it's going to pop back. It's got tensibility to pop back to its original position. The strength with which it returns, I can talk, the strength with which it returns to its original position, that is the contractility. Okay, so the case here of contractility is highly dependent upon calcium. So I want to mention calcium for just a moment. So way back when you studied calcium in Bio-210, why was calcium important for a muscle contraction? Binds to troponin complex, right? And that helps to reveal these ropes of tropomyosin, and then those myosin heads could reach up and form binding sites, and then they could pivot and pull and shorten this muscle. So the whole issue of having calcium here is it can increase the strength of contractility. So the more calcium you've got, the more binding sites you reveal and the stronger your contractions. So on your worksheet there, you'll notice that contractility is increased by calcium, by increased sympathetic stimulation, and even some other hormones like glucagon and thyroxine. What does glucagon do to you? Raises your blood sugar, right. So if you've ever had a really sugary drink or a really sugary meal, you might have felt hepped up and, you know, kind of like I can climb the mountains of the world. Okay, that's glucagon partly helping to increase the sugar, which increases contractility. What does thyroxine do? Metabolism. Increases metabolism. That too can increase the rate of metabolism in your heart. And one more thing there that's new for is something called digitalis. Ever heard of this one before? Okay. This particular medication may be given to people who have a weak, flabby heart, perhaps due to chronic heart failure. What will this drug do to their contractility? Increase it, right. So it strengthens the contraction, making that person have a more efficient heartbeat. You'll notice that contractility is decreased by potassium, drugs like calcium channel blockers. So the case of potassium is it resets the resting rate inside your muscle cells to more than just negative 70, perhaps negative 90 or negative 110. So we're heading in a hyperpolarized setup if we're looking at having excess potassium inside a muscle cell. So extra potassium is not a good thing. It can kill us. So that's why people with potassium imbalances are closely watched. Thinking big picture here, which hormone ultimately is responsible for dumping excess potassium? Aldosterone. Yeah, aldosterone's the big one there. Okay. Last issue is afterload. So what comes into the heart and is pumped out by contractility, is pushed out through the aorta and the pulmonary tract. That aorta and pulmonary trunk have a certain diameter. You can only force so much blood through there at a time, and you have to have the pressure to do so. So this is the pressure you must overcome in order to force the blood into those two large arteries and get it to go out to systemic flow. If I had to remember one word for afterload, I would think about the pressure that we're having to push to get that blood out of the heart. All right, so any questions there on those three terms? All right, just a little bit here on regulation of heart rate, which is back on page 45. Let's think big picture. What we're looking at here is cardiac output is dependent upon two variables. We just talked about preload, afterload, contractility that influence stroke volume. Talk about some things that influence your heart rate. I'm going to start you off with something familiar. When you studied the autonomic nervous system, there were two branches, a sympathetic branch and a parasympathetic branch. You may recall that the sympathetic branch has what impact on heart rate?
Increase it.
Good. Do you remember the two neurotransmitters that helped to work for this branch?
Epinephrine.
Yeah, good. Epinephrine and norepinephrine. So we know that sympathetic response is going to increase heart rate. Well, if you increase heart rate, what do you do to cardiac output?
Increase
that too, exactly. So we've talked about, you know, hormones. Here again, we've got epinephrine and norepinephrine that can work on increasing heart rate. Again, thyroxine, we just talked about glucagon increasing contractility and stroke volume. Now we also see it increases heart rate. Let's talk about ions for just a moment. So we just mentioned that calcium can increase the strength of a muscle contraction. If you increase the strength of the muscle contraction, you increase the contractility and in turn the stroke volume. It too can increase the heart rate. So thinking back, big picture here, what was the name of the hormone that increases blood calcium levels?
Parathyroid.
Yeah, that's it. PTH increases calcium. So we could look at the PTH hormone as being a problem for this one. Likewise, we just talked about aldosterone and its role in controlling potassium. Low potassium can also increase heart rate as well. Do you know of some potassium-rich foods you could supplement with? Yeah, juices like orange juice, bananas, good. Kiwi, yeah, that's a good one. All right, couple more things here. Fever gives you a fast heart rate. If you've ever been sick with an awful fever, you feel like your heart's going to beat out of your chest. And then our favorite drug here, caffeine. Caffeine speeds your heart rate too. So, on the other side, let's talk about what can decrease your heart rate. We again know that the autonomic nervous system has two branches. The parasympathetic branch has an important part called the vagus nerve. What impact does the vagus nerve have on your heart rate?
Slows it down.
You may recall that the vagus nerve is a strange one in terms of your cranial nerve setup. Most cranial nerves serve your head region, but not the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve branches, travels into your thoracic, and even into your abdominopelvic cavity to serve our thoracic and abdominopelvic organs. This is an important one throughout the heart because it directly innervates your SA node. You know, your SA node keeps pace about 75 beats per minute, but if the vagus nerve releases acetylcholine, your heart rate will then slow. So this particular nerve has a calming effect on your heart rate. A couple of terms there I do want to mention for you on your worksheet. You got a blank there to fill in. That's acetylcholine. Let's see, we've got vagal tone, which is the effect of the vagus nerve on the heart. And the default setting for the heart is to have the vagus nerve in control. So that means that we are looking for a lower resting heart rate, not one that goes higher and higher. In terms of those who are very athletic, like an Olympic type athlete, we are looking at a lower resting heart rate because the heart is more efficient as a pump. If you happen to have a vagus nerve that is overactive, what is the name of the drug that can negate or work against the effects of the vagus nerve? Well, atropine in this case, digitalin may increase the strength of contraction. But yeah, atropine is a good one too for increasing the effects, working against rather what the vagus nerve is supposed to be doing. For basovagal syncope, you'll notice the next one there, or syncope, that's just a fancy word that means fainting. And for people who often have a very strong vagus nerve, that vagus nerve is constantly working to do what to their heart rate? Decrease it, lower it, yeah. So for people that may faint frequently, they look and say, hey, is your vagus nerve extra happy? If it's extra happy, then let's negate the effects with something that helps to increase your heart rate. I also wanted to mention something called the vagal maneuver, which is next, sometimes called Valsalva maneuver. All right, so if you were to drop your pencil on the floor and bend over and pick it up, you would be holding your breath to do so. I promise you, you're going to do it, okay? So if you do anything where you bend over, tie your shoe, pick up something off the floor, you hold your breath. Try doing it without holding your breath. It's like impossible to do. So what you're doing is you're holding your breath by closing your vocal cords, and you seal off the exit of air coming out of your lungs. That keeps the air in your lungs, and it pushes down on your diaphragm. It creates pressure in your abdominopelvic cavity. Well, when you do this, you actually put a stimulus onto your vagus nerve. And when your vagus nerve is stimulated, guess what it releases lots of onto your heart? ACH. Yep, so it releases lots of ACH. And what happens to your heart rate? Let's see.
I'm going to test it out, right?
Test it out. Yeah, there you go.
This is very true.
Yep.
I never thought about it.
We don't think about yet that we do that all the time. So yeah, when you release a bunch of ACH, then of course your heart rate decreases. All right, so you say, well, what does this have to do with this chapter? Well, a lot of older people have bowel movement issues, right? They take constipating drugs. They also take drugs that lower their blood pressure and or heart rate. Now you put this person on a toilet with a hard bowel movement, and what do? They hold their breath. All right, what happens to their heart rate? Slows down. And we're going to learn that heart rate and blood pressure go hand in hand, so the blood pressure drops and they fall off the toilet, right? Okay, so that's the way Elvis went. You may or may not know his story, but he was on some medications, got up during the night to use the bathroom, sat on the toilet. I guess he tried to have a bowel movement, and somebody found him the next morning laying on the floor beside the toilet. So apparently it's a very common thing, especially if you take medications that lower your heart rate in the first place. So that's why stool softeners are good for older people that have these issues. Mm-hmm. Holding your breath through the Valsalva maneuver stimulates that vagus nerve. So I do want to mention that because we're going to bring it back up again when we talk about respiratory and all that good stuff. All right. So to finish out the list down there, let's see, we've got ions. This time we're going to flip-flop it. We know calcium is an excitable mineral for your heart. Not having enough of it has what impact on your heart rate? Yes, slow you down. Exactly. And high potassium, like we talked, can be bad for you. High potassium can stop your heart. Likewise, it can have a very detrimental or slowing effect on your heart rate. All right, and then finally down there at the very bottom, I did want to mention some medications for you. There's lots of medications that influence both heart rate and blood pressure. I just wanted to mention these three. Beta blockers, alpha blockers, and calcium channel blockers all block something that has an effect on your heart. Noticing there what beta blockers block, they're going to slow down the effects of epinephrine and norepinephrine. So will they speed your heart rate or decrease your heart rate?
Decrease.
Okay, so let me tell you about beta blockers. Way back in Bio-210, you may have learned about alpha and beta receptors. These are types of adrenergic receptors that sit on our plasma membranes. If you make a drug called a beta blocker, the blocker is meant to actually come in here and sit on that receptor site, blocking epinephrine or norepinephrine from doing their jobs. So the goal here is to keep those two neurotransmitters from communicating with and speeding up your heart rate. So I take a beta blocker. I have SVT, which is supraventricular tachycardia. And, you know, by itself, your heart may start going and racing and for no reason at all. Mm-hmm. And then it may return back to its normal speed. So by taking the beta blocker, my resting heart rate went from around 95 beats per minute to about 70-something beats per minute. So heart rate rise, I feel better. Now, we're going to learn later on that heart rate and blood pressure go hand in hand. So I didn't have a blood pressure problem, but I do now. It's too low. Yep. So I'm constantly drinking. You may notice half the time I have a glass of water or something in here with me. Those are the days where I'm feeling lightheaded, especially when it's hot. What does hot do to your vessels?
Dilate them.
Yeah. And we're going to learn that decreases pressure. Add that on top of a beta blocker, and there you go. So doubles the effect of that lower heart rate. So beta blockers block the effects of epinephrine and norepinephrine. You'll notice that there's also something called an alpha blocker on your worksheet. Alpha blockers actually lower the resistance to blood flow, so it makes it easier for blood to get to the vessels in your heart. And then third, there's something called a calcium channel blocker. Why might you want to block calcium from talking to your muscle cells? Stimulate it, yeah. Calcium stimulates your muscle cells in the heart. It makes the contractility increase. And if you've got hard, strong heart contractions, calcium channel blockers can block the effects of that calcium. So it lowers the rate, it lowers the stroke volume and the contractility there. Okay, so just wanted to kind of run you through that page. Do you have any questions so far? Let's see, just a couple of things to tie up the loose ends. Page 46 and 47 are it. Chronic heart failure, or CHF, is also known as congestive heart failure. And this may come from hardening of the vessels over a lifetime of, you know, that's what they do. They harden over a lifetime of perhaps diet. It is also genetically driven. And if we're not aware that it's happening, then the next thing you know is now you've got hardening of the vessels around the heart. High blood pressure is also an issue because it bangs up and bruises the insides of those vessels. What do multiple heart attacks do to heart muscle tissue? Scars it, yeah. So you end up with scar tissue. Does scar tissue contract like normal tissue? No. So unfortunately, scar tissue is not a good way to leave the heart. And then eventually the heart becomes less effective as a pump, and we have what's called dilated myocardiopathy or cardiomyopathy. This is an enlargement of the heart. It becomes less effective as a pump. So the issue here is that we may start with one side of the heart damaged or the other. We may not necessarily start with both sides failing initially. So let's talk about the left ventricle. We know the left ventricle is supposed to eject blood out into systemic flow, meaning where does it go?
To the body.
Good. Now, if the left ventricle is big and flabby and not effective as a pump, backflow the blood with me up through the bicuspid valve into the left atrium. What feeds blood into the left atrium? Pulmonary veins. Now you're going back to the lungs. Okay, that's what happens with left side heart failure. back it up, left atrium, pulmonary veins, back it into the lungs. So we end up having these kinds of symptoms here, feeling like you can't catch your breath, feelings of like suffocation, pulmonary congestion, excess fluid around the lungs. So the issue is that we're not effectively ejecting it out, we're actually letting it pull backwards into the previous pathway. This is a commonly missed question on test. You may want to mark this. Okay, so left side heart failure leads to lung issues. Sure. Anybody still need the slide? Okay, let's talk about right side heart failure. And again, the right side normally ejects blood out to the lungs. But if it's an ineffective pump, backflow it, take it into the SVC and IVC, and then appreciate the fact that we're usually in a standing position, so gravity is going to pull that blood where?
Down to your feet.
Down to the feet, yeah, down to the extremities. So there we go. This causes swelling in the hands, fingers, swelling around the ankles and the feet. So that blood is just going to slide back into the IVC and down into those extremities. So we do tend to see these swelling issues. You know, a person who maybe wasn't able to get their jewelry off, maybe their socks cut into their ankles or their feet. These are the kinds of warning signs we look for with right side heart failure. So yeah, these are two commonly missed things on the test. Just keep in mind that we're going to backflow it into the previous location. Checking to see if anybody needs the slide. Okay. And there's some treatments down there, diuretics, blood pressure medications, things like that, that we can treat those kinds of heart failure with. Why would digitalis be used? Increase the strength of contraction, right? So if you've got heart muscle that's flabby and ineffective as a pump, digitalis can increase the strength of that contraction. Ultimately, if the person's heart fails on one side, the other side has to overwork, and then both sides will fail. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, heart transplants may be the result for somebody with, you know, like a double side failure. So the last thing in this chapter I wanted to hit with you is myocardial infarctions or heart attacks. These are different from a case of angina because of the length of time the oxygen tissue, or the oxygen is being starved from that muscle tissue. Okay, so timing is everything. Angina is a short-term deprivation of oxygen, temporary. And a heart attack is a long-term deprivation of oxygen. Okay, so like I said, timing is everything. Short-term loss of oxygen to muscle tissue of the heart is termed angina, and long-term deprivation is termed myocardial infarction. Which one gives you a greater risk for muscle tissue dying? The heart attack, yeah. So there's classic heart attack signs that we've all heard about. What are some things that normally pop in mind when you think about heart attack signs or symptoms?
Left arm pain.
Chest pain.
Nausea,
shortness of breath. Okay. So these are classic heart attack symptoms. Why the left arm pain? Your heart's not over there, is it? Referred pain. Yeah, this is a case of referred pain. So we feel the pain there, perhaps in our left jaw, but in fact the heart sits in the middle of the thoracic cavity. We also experience nausea and perhaps stomach upset, clamminess. So thinking back, which autonomic nervous system branch likes to dominate? Para. Yeah. Parasympathetic, yeah. There is part of the reason for why we feel nauseated during a heart attack. Parasympathetic nervous system likes to be the dominant system. So if blood is not getting to your, you know, to your heart muscle tissue, you've got sympathetic and parasympathetic kind of battling it out, trying to get blood flowing through those vessels. So part of the reason for that, of course, is a parasympathetic-sympathetic battle that's going on. I do want to mention this. I know you can't read all the details here, but women may have different symptoms than men. What are some of the symptoms a woman experiencing a heart attack may have? Back pain. Jaw pain. One of you said something different. Epigastric pain. Yeah.
Pressure.
Yeah. A lot of women experience something that feels like an elephant sitting on her chest. She may feel pain in her back, like right through the other side of where the heart is sitting. Who thinks of that as being a heart attack, right? Okay. The other issues here are unusual fatigue. A lot of women may be experiencing symptoms over the course of several days, and they say, oh, you know, and they blame it on something. I'm really stressed out. I haven't gotten a lot of sleep lately. So-and-so was sick. I probably caught it from them. It's just the flu. I know I've gotten something. And they put excuses on other things because they think these symptoms match something else that they've seen. So, of course, you know, we want to pay attention to these kinds of symptoms, especially the one that has to do with the pressure sitting there on the chest. I had a student about two or three summers ago, and we covered this stuff in class, and she came up to me and she says, I've been having those symptoms. And she disappeared from my class and did not come back. She went to her doctor's office. She ended up having a three-way bypass that summer semester. Yeah, and then it was a full, I think it was a spring semester before she came back to class. So she was in tears because she said, had we not talked about this in class, it wouldn't have made the connection for, because she was one of these, you know, putting it off, saying it was something else or whatever. And she was really appreciative that we talked about it, because she said, hey, I recognized myself and those symptoms. So, you know, worthwhile. Sometimes I leave this as read-at-home material, but not after her case. She was in her early 50s when she had the bypass done. I thought, well, if it saved one life, then it's worth the 5 minutes to go over that material in class. So, you know, if you know somebody who, especially female, who has strange symptoms, you know, hasn't ever experienced anything like it before, then yeah, it's worth getting them checked just to see what's going on there, because that was the case with her. She rolled a book bag over this third floor walkway back and forth to the parking lot and was winded doing that. So, you know, you shouldn't necessarily be winded just walking on a flat surface with your rolling book bag, but, you know, she was finally putting all those symptoms together. So that is really the last new material for you. I just wanted to mention those symptoms. I'll let you read the rest of the treatments there. You guys covered foramen ovale and ductus arteriosus in lab? Okay, those are on the bottom in case you just want a recap of those. And so that should do it for the heart information. Did you have a blank? Okay. Just in the remaining few minutes, I'd like to get you started on blood vessels. Or would you like to read them at home? Just keep on rolling.
So
that's true.
We need to listen to you say it, or we got to read it ourselves.
Right.
So I'm going to listen to you say it. does.
I can probably do it faster than you can read it. Yeah. Okay, page 51. Just a little background here on blood vessel anatomy. Okay, so what we do today on blood vessels is lightweight. What we do on Wednesday, bring your live and active brain cells with you. There are two topics in there that we're going to hit. One is blood pressure, heart rate regulation. It's not bad. We just got to be able to think through it. And the other issue is bulk fluid transport and capillaries. And I promise you, that one's not bad. You just kind of get the swing of that one, too. So I'm glad we put back the test, because at least we'll be able to practice those again the following Monday. So in terms of general blood vessel anatomy, most have three layers. All right, so starting from the inside. Did y'all need blanks filled in? You got it. Any blanks y'all need? 43. The pressure, she's right. Yeah. Yes, the bottom of 43, you may wonder why mitral valve and aortic valves have more issues than, say, pulmonary valves or even tricuspid valve, and it has to do with the pressure on the left side of the heart. Okay, so greater pressure. Left side has greater pressure. Let's see, in terms of blood vessel anatomy, most blood vessels have three layers except for the capillaries. Capillaries have only one layer. We'll talk about those in a bit. So starting from the inside, we have an intimate layer that comes in contact with your blood, and therefore its name is tunica intima. You'll notice on your sheet it's made up of simple squamous epithelial tissue. So back when you guys studied all those tissue types for Bio-210 lab, you probably thought, check, that's done, you moved it out of your brain, but here it comes. Yeah, so blood vessel linings are simple squamous epithelium. The middle layer is tunica media. And that middle layer may be muscular or it may be stretchy and elastic. It may also be very thick, as in an artery, or it may be very thin, as in a vein. Since that tunica media does contain smooth muscle, if needed, it can constrict, called vasoconstriction. So right off the bat, we're going to go ahead and say that if you constrict a vessel and squeeze it tight, what happens to your blood pressure? It goes up, right? So if you think about it this way, if you're uptight and anxious about something, things get, you increase pressure. That's the same thing that happens to vessels. Squeeze them tight, pressure goes up. If you relax a vessel or vasodilate the vessel, what happens to pressure? Pressure goes down. So that middle layer is an interesting one. It is often innervated by your autonomic nervous system. But I need to be specific here. It is only innervated by the sympathetic branch. Notice that the parasympathetic branch does not innervate your tunica media. Okay, so I just want to mention that tunica media is innervated by your autonomic nervous system. But to be specific, it is just the sympathetic branch. Don't forget to hold your breath, Elizabeth, when you pick that up. Okay, I'm going to say it one more time because it's really important. Yes, you have autonomic nervous system innervation to your tunica media. It is sympathetic. There is no parasympathetic innervation to your vessels. So So what does the sympathetic nervous system do to your vessels? Squeeze them or relax them?
Squeeze them.
Squeeze them, yeah. And your blood pressure goes up. Let me put it to you this way. If you have sympathetic and no parasympathetic innervation to your blood vessels, it is like driving a car with a gas pedal only. And when you want to stop, you take your foot off the gas pedal and you just coast. How frightening would that be, right? Okay, so there's no brake pedal, there's no parasympathetic to dilate the vessels. All you can do is squeeze them or just stop squeezing them. That's your options. So that means that if you're stressed out and epinephrine and norepinephrine are squeezing the heck out of your vessels, when the trauma passes, you have to wait. You have to coast and wait for those vessels to eventually dilate. No wonder stress is so bad for us, right? It constantly keeps those vessels squeezed up tight. And then finally, the last outermost layer is an external layer called adventitia. It's collagen. These are steel cables that wrap around your vessel and keep it from expanding too much. So over a lifetime, what might make your vessels stretch and expand? Pressure. Yeah, blood pressure, right? So over a lifetime, high blood pressure can eventually stretch those vessels and make them really wide. So that's not good for regulating blood flow. So yeah, that's looking at things like aneurysms over, you know, years and years of high blood pressure. Let's see, let's run through a little bit about arteries there. We know that arteries carry blood away from the heart, almost always. And we color them red on models due to the fact that we expect oxygenated blood to be flowing through. Of course, there's exceptions, right? Okay, pulmonaries, we expect to see those reversed in terms of the pulmonary arteries and veins. So in terms of the thickness of the tunica media of an artery, there is quite a bit of muscular tissue or elastic fibers here. What type of pressure are these vessels experiencing? High pressure, exactly. So we either need muscle to help regulate the diameter of the vessel, or we need elastic fibers to be able to stretch as blood flows through. There's two types of arteries. There are, in fact, arteries that are mostly elastic fibers. They're built to be stretchy. And then there's muscular arteries that are built to be, guess what, muscular. So, I wanted to kind of talk you through the difference between these two kinds of vessels. When you're thinking about elastin as a fiber type, it is stretchy. And if you have pressure that's flowing through a vessel, you may want to stretch as the pressure of blood travels through. Notice the vessels closest to the heart that experience the highest pressure. That's all they do is they stretch and expand, and then they relax back to their original position. If you think about living for 80 years, 90 years, whatever, those elastic fibers eventually wear out, so you've got this big, flabby, open tube that no longer can stretch as blood travels through. That's one of the downsides of having high blood pressure. It can wear out the elasticity of those blood vessels. That's why older people have trouble regulating their blood pressure. They no longer recoil back to their original position after the pressure of blood travels through. Notice these muscular arteries have, guess what, muscle in them, and they're not necessarily regulating the highest pressures. These here, aorta, pulmonary trunk, common carotids, those deal with the highest pressures. These vessels are a little further away from the heart. They're still dealing with high pressure, but we may want to regulate the diameter of the vessel to control how much blood gets to a body part. Let's imagine that you're running and you need a lot of blood traveling down that femoral artery to your legs. Maybe you'll want to dilate that vessel to carry more oxygenated blood down to those leg muscles. So the muscle in those particular arteries are going to be able to constrict or dilate depending on what kind of stimulation we either turn on or turn off to get blood to those areas. Let's see, in terms of pressure points or pulse points, you guys are probably familiar with different places around the body, right? Let's see, well, I don't have a picture there. So besides your radial artery, what is another good place to detect pulse or pressure? Carotids? Femoral? Popliteal? Pedal, good. Brachial, good. Axillary, apical, not your thumb, right? Okay. And then I want to tell you about the trick here. If you have good pulse, good strong pulse, two fingers can probably block the flow and you can feel the pulse. When I started taking that beta blocker, I couldn't feel my pulse, and so three fingers can do the trick. Use your ring finger to push down and block the blood flow through the vessel. Then very gently lay these two fingers on the vessel, and then you'll feel the blood run up against that ring finger that's blocking the blood flow, and then you're going to feel that pulse. So for somebody who has a hard-to-detect pulse, this three, using the ring finger trick, can be an answer for you. So this seems like a good place to stop. We'll pick up with veins in here on Wednesday.